Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. Tonight, I'm going to tell you about a project I've been working very hard on. It's a new website dedicated to, quote, exposing the false testimony of the world's most famous Holocaust survivor, unquote. Now, who do you think that would be? Well, you know, I've been following the trail of evidence that negates Elie Wiesel's own version of his life story ever since Miklos Gruner's claims of fraud against Wiesel first came to light on the Internet. Elie Wiesel is such an obvious fraud that it is sickening to allow him to continue his charade. I'm not the only one who feels that way. Many are sickened by Elie Wiesel. So, with the help of Bradley Smith's CODO, CODO stands for Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust, we now have a stunning website with the title of Elie Wiesel Cons the World that challenges the Wiesel myth on all fronts. And I emphasize on all fronts. What we have there now is very tight evidence against the Wiesel myth, but it will continue. We will have more as time goes on, and it takes a little time to prepare all this because we're very scrupulous and scholarly oriented here, and we don't want to have anything blow up in our face, but there is a tremendous amount that is waiting to be discovered and put together and said and exposed about Wiesel. It's very fascinating, really, and I have to give the website. It is that's our email. It's Elie Wiesel Tattoo, www.eliewieseltattoo.com. So we've named it that because while we're challenging Wiesel on all fronts, the starting point of the challenge is, where's the tattoo? The tattoo is the Auschwitz number A7713 that Wiesel has claimed for years that he carries on his arm, but he refuses to ever show it to anyone. Now, Wiesel even stated under oath at the trial of Eric Hunt, which he had to be a witness of, a witness during, or at least he chose to be, in 2008, that he has this tattoo on his arm, and the number is A7713. But we have now clear photos of his left forearm from all angles, and there's no tattoo that appears anywhere. Now, this is not understood by the public, even when we show all this, because, for one thing, the location of the tattoo is misunderstood, and people want to think that, oh, a person could have had a tattoo anywhere on their arm, or either arm, right arm, left arm, and, you know, up close to their armpit or somewhere. This is not the fact. Of course, this would never be done by the Germans in this way. The location is on the left forearm, and while we see many people with tattoos on the inside of their arm, mostly they're on the outside of the arm, and there was a period of time possibly when they were putting them on the inside soft part of the forearm, left forearm, but there's still a lot of research needs to be done about that, about just where these tattoos were placed, because many people have put tattoos on themselves to claim that they are survivors when they're not, and it's very interesting. Now, another thing is who got tattoos. People also can't seem to keep it clear that only at Auschwitz were tattoos given to prisoners. No other camp, no other place in Germany or outer Germany or under the Nazis were people tattooed. Only at Auschwitz, the Auschwitz complex, Auschwitz-Birkenau, Monowitz, and they had their reasons for it, which I might go into another time, but And only the people who were registered there, because Auschwitz was a transit camp, Birkenau was a transit camp also, along with being in certain other types of camp. And it was so many people were brought there and stayed there for a short period of time and were then transferred somewhere else. And these people were generally not tattooed. Then there were certain number series of tattoos that you have to fit in with. And all of this is documented somewhere, some places, but it hasn't all been put together very clearly. And so there's lots of misunderstanding there. But the problem with understanding, I have noticed, comes even with people who come to our website in the short time that it's been online, a couple of weeks. Some people tend to look, you know, they look around, they read a few things, they glance over things, and then they think they know what's there, but they don't. They don't read it carefully. What we have is so detailed, and we're going to continue with very detailed information, and the detail is important. And so when you come to this website, you need to take the time for each page that we offer of evidence and information. You need to take the time to read it carefully and grasp what it's saying. Because otherwise, it's not just more of the same, oh, Elie Wiesel is a fraud, you know, Elie Wiesel is a liar. People know that, but in order to be helpful in bringing this idea to more people, you need to know all the reasons why, and you need to be more detail-oriented and be able to present these things in a proper way. Because the evidence against Elie Wiesel, let me put it this way. The legend of Elie Wiesel truly is based on a tissue of lies. It really is. It's a tissue of lies. And we do discover that. There is a book called Night that he wrote. And in the UK edition, it's a new translation translated by his wife, Marion. And it's copyrighted 2006, in which there is a preface to this translation that is something I've never seen. Elie Wiesel himself wrote a preface to it in which he says a lot of very interesting things that I'm going to get this book. And when I do, I will be discussing more about this. Right now, in speaking about how to deal with our website, talking about the menu bar is very important. And you need to go to that menu bar and you need to look under the evidence and particularly read that document page and understand what it says. And you need to go to projects, very important. And under projects, we have one project prepared now called Boston University. This is where we want people to become active and to begin some real activism in a way that is consistent and regulated, not just hit and miss or not just writing comments on the internet, but real work. And right now, I have a good friend who's become a friend in this whole Elie Wiesel affair that I've gotten involved in, who is going to talk with me now about this Boston University project. Stephen Bach, who's been helping with the website from the beginning and has been very active in the Elie Wiesel campaign, if you might call it that. And he has taken an interest in our Boston University project especially. And he has already done some work about it. He's already done some participation. So right now I'm happy to welcome onto the program Stephen Bach. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Carolyn.
Well, you have already done some... I've told the listeners that they need to go to the projects on the menu and click on Boston University and see what we have there and what we're asking people to do. And you've been involved in this project, and you have sent out letters. What can you tell us or tell them about this project and whatever your experience has been with it?
Well, actually, the first time I heard about Elie Wiesel was, I saw Henry Macau's article, mm-hmm. and I said, well, that's interesting. He sounds like he's, maybe not who he says he is, but I didn't really think that much about it until I heard you on your show, and you said, well, this is a wonderful opportunity to do some real damage to the, you know, the Holocaust. So, you know, I took an interest in it, and then I saw that you, you know, putting up your website, the LeWeaselTattoo.com, and you suggested that people write to the faculty, the I guess the Department of Philosophy, and you listed, you know, many or, you know, maybe all of the you know, members of the, you know, that department.
Yeah, we got it right off the Boston University pages. It's wonderful. Every head of the Department of Philosophy, of the administrators who have positions, and then the entire faculty, full-time faculty, and they have all their emails and their addresses and so on and what they do. And so we have it all there presented on our Boston University project page. And that's what you used, correct?
Right, and then of course it's you kind of put the evidence together in your first few shows on the Heretics Hour, and you know you were talking about how you know you talked about Ellie's the number A7713, and how the Ellie was born in 1928, but the documentation from the, you know, Auschwitz Museum archives indicate that the person with that number was born in 1913.
Mm-hmm.
And also, he says that his father, Shlomo, was given the number A7712, but that number was registered to somebody named Abraham Wiesel, not Shlomo. So, well, just...
Yes.
Kind of put that together, and then I composed an email, and I put those together, and I asked, you know, I said, you know, dear sir, you know, Ellie Wiesel is a honorary professor at your university, and you know, but he's never proven that, you know, he's been a survivor. He's never been asked to prove that fact. So, you know, but I listed out the, you know, the contradictions and the discrepancies, and I said, well, you need to, you know, you need to explain these, you know, why, how can he say that he was born in 1928 and yet the documents show that, you know, his number, you know, was assigned to a person born in 1913?
Well, these are details, Steve, that they just they just brush over all these things. You know, nobody ever answers. Have you noticed that? Well, go ahead, and then I'll bring this up afterwards. Go ahead with what you're saying.
Well, yeah. So I sent that out Saturday, and it's I guess this is being recorded. You know, today's Friday, and I haven't heard a response yet. But I'm going to, you know, keep pursuing it. I'll, you know, send follow-up emails, and I'll. Maybe I'll try calling them up and, you know, nicely ask them, you know, well, can you explain these?
Or, yeah. That's what you need to do, because we know that when we send, whoever sends these emails to these people, and, you know, you can write one nicely written, and what I like about you, Steve, is that you're a very good writer, and all of your spelling and punctuation is absolutely correct and is well put together, and you're polite, but you're not overly polite in that you're not wimpy about it. You know, you're strong, and that's all very good, and that's what people need to remember. We have to remember that when we are doing this kind of work, we have to make the impression of intelligent people. We can't make an impression of uneducated people who are somehow making a mistake, but you don't have to be perfect. I'm not saying that. But we do want to have the right, you know, have a proper, you know, respectful, doesn't have to be overly respectful, but a respectful attitude toward these people. But they are not going to respond. I mean, the thing is, what we need is, well, somebody might somewhere along the line, but I doubt it. So it don't, it's not whether they respond or not. It's how many messages they get. You see, if they get a message from you, now they've gotten one from Stephen Bach, they can, that can be deleted. You know, they forget about that. But if they keep getting them, and if they're getting them from lots of places, this is why we want many, many people to participate in this. And we've tried to make it easy for them because we've got all the information there. They can write one nice letter, and then they can email it to all of these addresses that are here, just as you did. And then when they don't, you know, a week later, they can send another one and say, maybe add, well, I didn't get a reply from you on this. But, you know, they may just keep me. But they will know. That's the point. You see, they will know that a lot of people are doing this. And as we know, for every, generally for every person who writes, there's 10 or 20 who feel the same way at least. And in this case, it would probably be more. But, and people know that. So, you know, if they would get 10, even 10 emails from different people about this subject, it would make an impression on these people. They'd say, oh, I don't, you know, there's something going on here. And maybe we can't ignore it. This is why I'm talking about this on the air, because I want to encourage people to not just come to the website and look at it and say, well, that's all interesting, and be entertained by it. I want them to do a little work and help us bring about an atmosphere where there is pressure. There is real pressure on Elie Wiesel or on the people who are supporting him, protecting him, and giving him refuge and so on. Right? And well, so you're willing to do that. And I hope that many other people will join in with what you're doing. And then we will see something happening. So, and you are also, maybe you want to tell us how you are also the one, you responded to the call for people to go to Chapman University and demonstrate when Elie Wiesel was speaking there. And as far as I know from people who have contacted me, you're the only one who has actually gone out to demonstrate at an Elie Wiesel function for all the ones that I was calling people to do in the spring. He hasn't been speaking anywhere lately. And so tell us a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, well, I didn't do that much. I mean, I didn't really know, you know, what I wanted to do. But, yeah, I heard you call saying, well, there's a Elie Wiesel, you know, event at Chapman. And I looked it up and said, hey, that's close by. I can get there in like 30 or 40 minutes. And, but then, you know, I read, you know, the tickets would only be available to students. So I wouldn't be able to, you know, go inside and, make a dramatic appeal to Elie to, you know, show his tattoo or to explain the, you know, why, you know, the 1913 versus the 1928 discrepancy. But anyway, I went down there and, you know, I brought some flyers and, you know, you had said that, well, if you really announce yourself, they'll try to, you know, the administration will try to get rid of you. So I said, well, I'll just kind of like, hang out, kind of out of sight. And, you know, if I see people going into the, you know, going to the hall, I'll try to, pass out a flyer to them. But, you know, I didn't want to be too pushy because, you know, the people who, you know, admire Elie, you know, Wiesel, you know, they're maybe a little bit vulnerable or, you know, they're not, you know, they think he's a great person. Mm-hmm. They don't want to, you know, like, mm-hmm. you know, really be abrasive and, you know, just.
That's right.
Yeah, so I said, well, you know, as they were passing, and there were mostly women, like, you know, women who were attending, there'd be groups of women going by. And by the way, when, you know, I saw when I came up there that, you know, people were greeted by outside, you know, they went up these stairs up, you know, like a church, and they were like greeted outside by, you know, women greeters, and they would like, you know, hold their, you know, grab their hands or, you know, shoulders and give them a little squeeze or, you know,
Yeah, very warmly, like, oh, we're, you know.
Yeah. And so, so as people pass by, I would say, well, are you going to Elie Wiesel then? And say yes. And I would say, well, do you want to, I have information, it's anti-Wiesel or, it criticizes, Wiesel. Would you like to take it? And they almost all said no, except one guy who, the only guy that I saw passing by, he said, yeah, sure, show me what you have, so I gave it to him, and, he folded it up, he didn't put it in his pocket, I think he folded it up, because, I had that photo montage that, I guess I'd mention, Eric Hunt, mm-hmm. that they made of, where's Wiesel's tattoo, mm-hmm. so he kind of folded it up so it wouldn't be obvious when he was, going into the Elie Wiesel event. But so I'm sure he looked at it maybe later, whatever. But
would you do that again? Would you tell them in advance, I have something here that's critical of Elie Wiesel or that's against Elie Wiesel as they're coming to the Wiesel function and ask them if they wanted it, or would you just hand it to them? Because even if
in most events I would, I know, the Liberty Lobby people have demonstrated against John Hagee. You can be more aggressive there, but
you have to be willing to have people throw away your, your flyers, because I know it costs money and takes time to make them. But if they just take it and look at it, then they see where's the tattoo and they see the pictures. You did a nice flyer there with the image on it. Throw it away and say, oh, my God, they've looked at it and it's made, it's made an impression. They know what you're talking about. So that's why I would just pass them out. But then I'm pretty aggressive and let them have their reaction, whatever it might be. They might throw it back at me or drop it down on the ground and I'd have to pick it up. But I don't think I would announce. You can still be polite. You're just saying, you're just holding it out, and they take it or they don't.
Yeah, I would be more aggressive next time, but I want to do, next time. So I think instead of passing out the flyers, I would bring a, what do you call it, a poster or something and announce myself a little more and, bring a stapler and put the flyers on their, that they have poster boards there.
Oh, okay.
So you do want to be a little more prepared than I was. And if you can get into the actual event, well, that would be, that would be perfect.
Yes. Well, as we continue with our Elie Wiesel challenge, Elie Wiesel already has a lot of security around him, and it will only increase. So it's pretty hard to get into these events. They're making everything very difficult to get near this man. So, you showed a lot of initiative. You've done more than most people will ever do. And it wasn't even just in you had to even drive 30 or 40 minutes to get there. So you did make even that extra effort. And so I really commend you for that. And you learned a lot from doing it. And this is the kind of thing that we hope, more people will do. And if you could have, if you had, two or three other people with you, what a nice, with some signs and so on, what a nice thing that would be. But right now we're going to have, our projects, and this Boston University project is an excellent one. It's the one we've begun with, and it's one that we want. This is where, of course, Elie Wiesel is a professor and has been for a long time at this university. They don't demand much of him there, but, they will argue with me about that. But this is a place where there can't be too many people emailing these people in his department of philosophy. And putting the pressure on, saying, we know all this stuff about Elie Wiesel, and you've got him here, upholding his everything he says about himself, and it's false, and you need to answer for it. So this is where we're going. And Steve and I, our time is up. I really appreciate you coming on and talking to our listeners about this. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
All right. And so we're going to move on to our second segment now after the break, ladies and gentlemen, with Gunter Deckert from Germany. So please stay tuned for that.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is likely to agree to an international investigation of his country's storming of an aid ship in May. The controversy caused by the Gaza aid flotilla killings has put international pressure on the Jewish state. Well, for more, I'm now joined live by our correspondent, Paula Sleer, who's in Tel Aviv for us. Hi there, Paula. Of course, Israel has never before allowed UN or international investigations into Israeli Defense Force operations. What prompted Israel to even consider agreeing to it this time?
Well, what you say is correct. What we're hearing is that in principle, Israel will agree to a United Nations probe into the flotilla raid back in May. Now, this is unprecedented. It's also significant because on the 9th of June, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is on record as saying that he will never allow for an international probe, that this sets a dangerous precedent. And you need to remember, of course, that previous investigations have never had any kind of Israel participation, previous international investigations. And this is because Israel believes that primarily the United Nations and other international bodies prejudge it before actually coming here. But what we're hearing now is that the Israeli Prime Minister has tasked his defense minister, Ehud Barak, to tell American officials, where he is at the moment in New York, that Israel, in principle, will agree to handing over papers and putting forward its argument in what happened in this Gaza flotilla raid. It seems that international pressure has played its part. The diplomatic fallout was unprecedented. You had demonstrations and marches throughout the world. You had countries calling Israeli ambassadors for some kind of explanation as to how their navy had behaved in this Gaza flotilla. And here in Israel, you also had many governments considering, in fact, some going as far as to do so, to actually recall their ambassadors from here.
What about the people in Israel? What's the feeling amongst Israelis about the aid flotilla incident and, of course, its after effects?
Most Israelis still believe that this was a deliberate provocation. They do not believe that the Gaza flotilla was a humanitarian aid effort. They believe that there were a significant number of militants on board, especially on board the Turkish ship, and they do also think that there was an attempt to try and smuggle weapons into Gaza. Having said that, though, there is criticism and a lot of debate here among the Israeli public as to how the Navy conducted itself, with questions being raised, and some of these questions, in fact, were raised by an internal Israeli military probe. It questioned and it actually put forward the suggestion that there had not been sufficient intelligence gathering and also that there were question marks over the way the army handled itself. So these are the questions Israelis have as to why their navy in fact had to behave in such a way that it left 9 people dead. But they haven't actually criticized the fact as to whether or not the flotilla was legitimate, most Israelis believing that it wasn't. I want to though also add on that point that there is a small voice within Israel, a voice that does support the international community's call for the lifting of the blockade, with some Israelis holding demonstrations and some Israelis saying that in fact this flotilla was a humanitarian effort and it should have been allowed to pass through into Gaza.
What about the people of Gaza? Has anything changed for them? We heard talk from Netanyahu and Obama while they had their meeting in Washington about a month ago. Has it really eased in the past couple of weeks?
By and large, I would say that life has not really changed for the people of Gaza. What we did see after this flotilla raid and the unprecedented international criticism was Israel easing the blockade. What this means, though, is that most goods are allowed in, and here we're talking primarily consumer goods, from food items to school books to most items that people need for their daily use. But there are still a lot of items that are on the blacklist, and these include, of course, weapons, and they also include items that are called dual purpose, so items that could be used as weapons. One of the big question marks is over building materials with the people of Gaza.
The Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and I now have the privilege of talking to Günter Deckert, who is a major right-wing figure in Germany. He's the former leader of the National Democratic Party. Of course, he's been on this program twice before, so most of you will remember him or already know of him. The National Democratic Party is what's known as the NPD in Germany. It's been constantly harassed by the centrist and leftist controlling elements. And Günter himself has been unjustly imprisoned in the past and also harassed in many ways. And he's now facing some new complaints and charges. And we're going to find out what that's all about right now. Hello, Günter. How are you?
Hello, Carolyn. Well, quite fine, in spite of the problems I get for the moment.
All right. Well, please, let's start right out and tell us about that, because I know you have written a report about it, but it's in process of being translated for those of us who cannot read German, and that has translation hasn't come out yet. So we're getting an exclusive here, so please explain the background and what's going on.
Yes, well, it's about revisionism or revision of history, and maybe some of your listeners know that partisan admirer of Harry Elmer Barnes with his school of revisionism. And as a German, while speaking, writing English and French, I was very early interested in problems of history, sure, Second World War history, and in this part, the history of the Third Reich and the policy towards the Jews. And I had translated a lot of articles, even books, the past concerning the subject. And when it's now 3 years ago, the people in Great Britain doing historical review press asked me to look after the not finished translation of Carlo Martoglio's book or work about Auschwitz, the first guessings, myth or reality. I set to work and finished it, doing some translation passages and trying to put it in normal German. Knowing that this topic in the smaller China today is quite a delicate one, I asked some lawyers how to behave in order not to get into new troubles, meaning fines and prison. I was told that it might be a help if I put before the foreword a sentence stating that I do not agree with the thesis and conclusions of the author, the same problem as if you are on the internet and you say, well, the links I sent you do not reflect my personal opinion. The book was sent out about 2 years ago, and the German thought police got one via a spy, an undercover man of what he called the Verfassungsschutz, that is an office, so-called office for the protection of our constitution, which isn't one. And yes, and it was sent to the prosecutor's office at Mannheim, my special friend Grossmann, who was responsible for the trials against Zündel, Rudolf and Sylvia Stolz. And I had the sword police in my house last year. They took away my computer and tried to find out what was my part in the translation work. First, they thought I was the author of the book. I had printed it, and I was responsible for distribution. That was wrong. They didn't find anything on my computer, but due to this special German law or code, it's the paragraph 130, I was classified as a contributor, as a hand, as a helper, that is, in the Germany of today, a crime too, a thought crime too. In the beginning, the lawyer I consulted was quite confident that there were no problems for me, but I quickly realized that 130 is, well, a paragraph is a code you may compare with the Inquisition courts of the Middle Ages. If a German tries to discuss or help to discuss the problem of the Jewish people of the Third Reich, it is from the very beginning a crime. There's no way, no possibility of winning a trial. You get judged, you get fined, or you are put into prison. I try to make clear that in a free state, and Germany likes to call itself a democracy, it must be possible that you can discuss in a fair way any problem in history that is argument against argument, and not only one argument is the right one. And if you help to bring forward, to inform people of other arguments in such a question, you are regarded as a criminal and you are put in front of a court and you get, well, judged, fined, or put into prison. That is the reality of the Germany of today.
Yes, and so what exactly are they charging you with now? That you contributed to this book?
Yes, yes, the only, well, I made it possible that the Mattondio text, who was first published in Italian about 15 years ago, in English, I think, 8 years ago, was now possible for a German to read as well, to get it via England and to get informed what the arguments of Mattondio are concerning the, well, the historical fact, in between quotation marks, of the first guessings at Auschwitz concentration camp. And the German is not allowed to help to bring forward that book and even to read it, to get it. And anyone who orders it in England and it get and it and the police gets it, he will be a judge, he will be brought before court too, because he's not allowed to bring into this country material, well, denying the Holocaust in any way possible.
Did you think that this was all right for you to do, but you're finding out now they're telling you that
when I contact somebody in the world, what you do, there's no problem so far. You are not the author. You do not defend his conclusions. Mm-hmm. You only help, well, people get some information in German, which so far have only been possible in accessible in English or in Italian.
All right,
but
so
they
now
were wrong. But they were wrong, as yesterday's on as the trial at Wednesday proved.
Yes. So now, how does it stand for you?
The executioner wanted 4 months of prison, and the final judgment is 4 months of prison on, what do you call it?
Probation.
Yes, that's on probation.
On probation.
Yes, on probation. Probation of 2 years and a fine of 600 euros.
I thought from what somebody explained to me, it was 4 months probation.
Probation plus 600 euros fine, plus the cost of the court, about, well, 1,500 euros apart from the 4 months on probation. But I, even in the courtroom, I, well, appealed. And so the case will be brought before the Mannheim District Court, I think, late in this year, and I will attack in another way. For me, was this first instance was a possibility to find out how the prosecutor and the judge, only one man sitting, judge, tried to explain to the public and to me why I had, well, committed a new thought crime.
Well, aren't there ever any jury trials in Germany? Don't they have juries?
No. The juries had been abolished, I think, 30 years ago. Normally, you are right. normal people.
For everything.
The reason is quite clear. Normal people, after the tourist thing, say, well, what has Günter Decker done? I got a lot of phone calls. You only finished a translation to the German, or the readers, or the people speaking or reading German are able to follow the arguments of a foreigner. Mm-hmm. And they don't understand, but, well, that is the political and judicial reality in our country of today.
Well, what about a murder or something? Is there a jury for that? Are there ever any jury trials?
They've got what we call a one-sitting judge, or a judge with two people, civil people, but the judge is the boss.
Oh.
And then in the appeal instance, you've got what we call a small court that implies one judge plus two civilians. We call it Schöffen. I don't know the English expression. It's a people elected by the parties who sit by and can, well, give advice, but they are not responsible for the final judgment. And they got what we call the grand court, consisting of three professional judges and two normal people, only sitting by as a kind of alibi.
It's very frightening. That seems frightening to Americans. Well, what is the hope here? I mean, you're going to appeal. What do you think?
Maybe you bring forward other arguments. I had a paper worked out by Horst Mahler of 13 pages to get the possibility to immediately address what they call our highest constitutional court, but the judge refused, and though I will try at the appeal court again to get this paper to Karlsruhe, though that this court finally will state what is, well, possible compared to what is written down, laid down in the basic law called our constitution. I will use another tactics. I will attack more. I will demand more proofs by the court, and to make them get more into the details of the topic.
And as you move along, do they just keep adding court costs? So it just the fine, if they continue to find you guilty, just grows and grows, or can they not do that?
Pardon?
Well, you know, it's like as you appeal, You have then more court costs. Or do they just
throw these court costs
on you if you don't win?
The court costs, well, are not the problem. They are not too high. But I will give you some people who help me to pay for them. That's not the problem. I will try to bring the problem more into public. Last Wednesday it was only a small public, and the article in our, well, local press was not too bad, as my wife, even my wife said. But they didn't bring or report the main aspects of what I had to bring forward. And I think with the Mannheim District Court, I may get a broader public and even to attract, let's say, more from the media to get it on a national level.
So we all need to be writing and passing this information around as much as possible. And, of course, you have written about it. And
once
it is being translated, yes.
Yes, once you get the translation of my report, it's a very good idea to, well, publish in a very wide range. People get informed and even may write a letter, well, a friendly letter to the judge of the Weinheim local court.
Yes, and the wonderful Mr. James Damon is translating it. He's probably working on it right now. You know, I met him last weekend.
Kicks to James.
Yes, wonderful, wonderful man. I don't know what I'd do without
him. Right you are.
Yes. Well, if there isn't anything more for us to understand about that, can we talk for a little bit about this poor Samuel Kuntz, 88, who has been charged with the death of 430,000 people, camp inmates. People are just amazed at this story. Of course, we have Demjanjuk, who's charged with, I think, what is he, 200 and some thousand, or is it 100 and some thousand? But now this man, they've got 430,000. Is that the entire number of deaths at the Belzec
camp? Yes, well, I think
they think that's overrated also. I couldn't possibly be that many. But so everybody who died at Belzec, because this man was a 20-year-old guard there at the time, and he's still alive, and the Simon Wiesenthal Center has been, you know, targeted him and can still find him and put him on, they can still find someone to put on trial. So now the German judiciary is cooperating, and they're doing this with this man. What else can you tell us about this?
Yes, I think if everything is right, what at least you may read on BBC News, he will make his way in the Guinness Book of Records as the world's, well, mass murderer par excellence.
Yeah.
It's quite crazy.
He's worse than a serial murderer who actually, you know,
yes,
who
yes,
actually
yes, yeah, well,
pulls
yes.
out really
he
does
will make
kill.
His way as the world's, well, biggest mass murderer of history. Well, I think, as I told you before, in the normal German media, even in the Spiegel, our well most known weekly, I read constantly. So far, there has not been any comment on that new case. I only was informed by you when asking me, and by friends in England and France who sent me via email some well articles. I think the people abroad, even above all those Jewish circles, are more interested in the case than the German public, who is fed up with all that.
Do you think it's the public, that because the public is fed up, or because they don't want to tell the public, the media, she keeps it under wraps somewhat?
And that's why that the normal media so far have not mentioned the new case. Otherwise, I would have read it in the Mannheimer Morgen or even other, what they call, national white paper. So far, I didn't read anything. Maybe I overlooked it, possible, but it's not top news for us, because I've got so many cases of code 130 that people aren't any more interested, and the media realize that there's no, well, interest in such topics. Maybe...
Well, of course. Couldn't you? It's also not in the in just the regular little newspapers around here either, unless it would be a little tiny story. It's just passed around on the internet from the Jewish sources,
mostly organizations
that have their websites, and then BBC has a story, but it may not be in the in the actual newspapers pushed very much.
Yes, it's well. I think for them, it's another chance of attacking the German public and thus trying to make the Germans understand what they do in Palestine and in the Gaza Strip, or to calm down any protest against the Israel-Jewish policy in the Palestine and Gaza areas, or to calm them, I don't think, or to get out more money.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as far as I know, even in the Spiegel was mentioned that the Netanyahu government tries to get more military equipment, submarines, for example.
Well, I think it also shows...
And they don't want to pay for them, and they try to get them as a present to stress the permanent, the eternal friendship between the German and the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think it also shows the power of the Simon Wiesenthal Center, which keeps pushing the German government to prosecute these people. Or there's, you know, this fellow.
Yes, I think that is it's meant to impress or to put pressure on the now German government under this bad girl Merkel, who does everything but not fight for the German interests, who does everything to please the world outside Germany, whatever she does. It's possible that the parties in Berlin are put under pressure, or should be put under pressure, those that they, accept the demands from abroad, special groups from abroad. That's possible. A new attack on our finance, on our money.
I just keep asking this. I know it sounds like I'm naive or something, but when is Germany going to stop doing this? Now, let's go to the story about.
Karen, we have got a new kind of president. This Christian Democrat Wolf, which is a crazy man, who in his inaugural address wishes that our country becomes a Khalat or a half-caste republic. And he says in the address, well, that we are in, well, that he got an eternal guilt towards the Jewish people, and which is everlasting, though we can't get rid of it. That is a kind of moral insanity in my mind.
Yeah,
and
this is...
It needs normal people to say, well, history is history, done is done, shut up. We won't talk about that anymore, won't get what is put under pressure.
This is
means
vengeance.
To make the
Don't
German people obedient.
Yes, but this is vengeance. This is eternal vengeance of the Jews against
Germany. Yes, eternal vengeance. Yeah, yes,
never
yes.
End. And this is what I've talked about Elie Wiesel just prior to our conversation.
Yeah.
He personifies that in so many everything he says. You can find that thread of that. It's really hateful. Talk about hate. Whew. All right. So now, but we have Turkey in their effort to join the European Union, and now I've just been reading that France and Germany are not really wanting Turkey, but the UK, and under the new PM Cameron, he's pushing for that. What do you have to say about that?
Well, if there would be what you call a public vote or a vote of the inhabitants, there would be no entry of Turkey into the European common market. I don't know why the new British government is in favor of it, because they think the Turks preferred going to France and Germany and not crossing the channel to enter Great Britain. I'm not quite sure what Cameron has in mind when he is in favor of Turkey entering the European car market, because Turkey has got financial problems as well. Turkey has got ethical problems, new ones with the Kurds, and that means importing new problems in this European common market. We've got enough problems with Greece, with Portugal, with Spain and Ireland, and they are collapsing economies. I don't know what you should ask Lady Renouf or other person in England, what is the British policy towards Turkey, towards employment. And interesting, the Brits are not in the what you call Euro community, though they don't pay for Greece, Spain or Portugal. So they still stick to their currency, the British pound. So
yes,
they say, well, if you're not a part of the Euro community, if Turkey enters, we don't pay for them. Possible.
Well,
maybe, maybe to help the Jews. I don't know what the British think of a Turkey entering the European Common Market. It is a big danger, because the difference in social life, let's say, income, social security, is very, very big, and it means that more Muslims entering the heartland of Europe, creating more problems, and we have got ethical wars, religious wars, we have got more and more foreigner crimes, quite normal in Berlin, in all the big cities of Western Germany, not in Central Germany, but in the old Bundesrepublik. And it's crazy that, well, the now boss of not quite an important country in Europe, well, is in favor of Turkey entering the European community. I don't understand. It's impossible.
Yes, well, it seems to me it's always the banking interests that are behind everything, and the idea of the globalism and the one world order, and of changing the demographic.
I don't know if there are special economic interests, or, well, it's an exchange of goods from Britain to Turkey. Britain in the last years or the last decades, well, has developed into not a country producing, well, goods, but more or less a country handling finance, not? The city of London has become the Wall Street of Europe with all the problems they have now. But I don't see, maybe they try to create, well, a new border state against Iran. That is a problem Turkey is already a member of the NATO. If there is war on the Iranian-Turkish border, German troops must march too.
All right. Well, Günther, we have run out of time. Yeah. I thank you for telling us about your current difficulties, and I certainly wish you all the best luck in all of this. And we're going to follow up with you regularly and see how this is going. It's always a great pleasure to talk to you, and I know that the listeners enjoy it. So thank you very much.
So do I. Thank you very much, and have a good time.
Thank you.
Bye.
Good night. And ladies and gentlemen, that's it for tonight. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.